From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with David Laskin, author of The Family, which tells the story of the Jewish 20th century through the experience of one ordinary, extraordinary family. A century and a half ago, a Torah scribe and his wife raised six children at the western fringe of the Russian Empire. The pious couple expected their sons and daughter to carry the family traditions into future generations, but history decreed otherwise. The upheavals of the last century split the family into three branches. One immigrated to America and founded two businesses, including the fabulous Maiden Form Bra Company. One went to Palestine as pioneer farmers and participated in the violent birth of the State of Israel. The third branch remained behind in Europe and suffered the onslaught of the Nazi occupation. One family, three paths, and the epic history of the Jewish 20th century. When I spoke to David Laskin, I began by asking him what he knew about his family history before he wrote the book.
The book really focuses on the three different branches of my family. Branch number one came to the U.S. around the turn of the last century and went into business, and one of those businesses was the fantastic, fabulous Maiden Form Bra Company,
right,
by my great aunt. Branch number two went to what was then Palestine in the 1920s as really idealistic Zionist pioneers, and their dream was to return to the Holy Land and farm, really make the desert bloom. So I certainly knew about the first branch growing up. That was my branch, and I knew Idle, as we called her, Aunt Idle, Ida Rosenthal to the world, the founder of Maiden Form, and my grandfather and his brothers went into their own business, which my father ended up working for. So that branch, those stories, the Maiden Form Dream Campaign, which became so iconic in the 1950s, all of that was kind of part of my childhood. The Israeli branch was a little more abstract to me. I knew we had relatives there. I'd never met them. I'd heard a couple of stories, some of their names. One of them my grandparents referred to as Uncle, and it was never quite sure why he never had a last name. He was just always Uncle.
Uh-huh.
So I was aware, but that was a little dim. The third branch, the relatives who were killed in the Holocaust, was totally unknown to me. Their names were never mentioned. Their stories were never told. And, that was a blank. So it really, as I said, the book is about how the three branches of my family became two. But growing up, I really did not know that we even had three branches. So the discovery that there was this third branch is really what prompted me, inspired me to write the book.
Okay. And this is all your mother's side of the family, correct?
This is my mother's side, correct. So
okay.
My mother's father was named Sam Cohen, and the name changed. It was basically the same name, but it changed its form a little bit depending on the language. So in Hebrew, HaKohen, it just means the priest. Cohen means priest in Hebrew. In Russian, it was Kahanovich, which means son of Cohen. In English, it became Cohen. So it sounds like three different names, but it's really the same.
Okay. And now I was interested that part of the way the book began for you was there was this legend in the family that Stalin's infamous goon, Lazar Kaganovich, was related to you. So can you talk about that?
Of course, yeah. So this is one of these family stories. I think we probably all have them in our families that you hear. And, it seems kind of strange that we would be related to this Stalinist henchman who was really in charge of an early version of the KGB. But I'd heard stories. I really didn't make much of it. But then at some point, I began to ponder this. I thought, why is this guy in our family tree? How exactly are we related? And then there was a biography of Stalin that came out a couple of years ago, and I looked at it. I read through it. I didn't really read it carefully, but I kind of flipped through it. And there was this name, Kahanovich, and I thought, wow, that's our family name. So that kind of got me thinking. And then at some point, the light bulb that you hope, sparks a brilliant new idea went off. And I thought, whoa, I could write a book about how my family was so divided between, A, the Stalinist henchman who was responsible for this horrible famine in Ukraine, and on the other side of the ocean, my Aunt Idle, who was making a fortune selling brassieres. What a great story, you know, the henchman and the tycoon.
Right.
You know, bras and the Kremlin and, oh, you know, I just had the whole kind of thing playing out of my mind. Then I started to do a little research, and I discovered that this Lazar Kahanovich, this henchman, did not come from the same part of Russia as my family, so that kind of got me wondering.
Right.
And then I asked my mom, and she said, well, you know, this was my understanding, and I was heard it from my cousin Barbara, and I contacted her cousin Barbara, and she said, oh, yes, this is, you know, my father talked about him. And had what a mean little boy he was, so that sounded plausible. But, you know, there were still some doubts in my mind. So I ended up emailing my cousins in Israel. Now, these, as I said, these are cousins who I kind of knew of but really didn't know. But my mother had been in touch with them, and I thought, you know, it might be nice to establish contact, and their English is good enough, and my Hebrew is not at all existent, but they're fine. So we emailed back and forth, and I would say the second message I got from my cousin Shimon was, Lazar Kahanovich is not on our family tree. My mother said we are not related. So I thought, okay.
The end.
That ends that. And in some ways, there was a sigh of relief. You know, you don't want to have a monster being your cousin,
right,
or your uncle or whatever he was. So, you know, I thought, well, okay, that's the end of that project. But then I began, you know, now that I had this contact with the Israelis, and they were so friendly and so, you know, kind of welcoming, and, you know, we emailed about family matters. And then I said, well, you know, tell me a little bit about your family. What did your parents get to Israel or then Palestine? And they told me the stories, and I thought, wow, you know, they were there quite early. You know, they were pioneers. They were among the founders of this nation. And then I said, well, you know, tell me about the rest of the family. And they were the ones who revealed the story of the relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. And in fact, they have put together a website, which they sent, you know, they sent me the URL, and there were these photographs of little girls with ribbons in their hair and little boys in sailor suits and their parents and their grandparents and, you know, just these beautiful, touching old photos from the 1930s, and all of these people were killed in the Holocaust. And that was when I really thought, whoa, this is an amazing story. I mean, in some ways, it's the whole sweep of 20th century Jewish history in one family. And that was when I thought, oh, you know, forget Lazar Kahanovich. I have a much, much more important and disturbing and far-reaching story to tell.
Right. And the story did, in fact, bring you to tell the histories of Jews in America, Jews in Eastern Europe, and Jews in Israel, or at the time it was Palestine. And it, you know, it was so fascinating the way you were able to weave these stories together. But before we go further there, I was backing up just a little bit. I was taken with your tone that you established right away in the book, right on page one, when you're talking about your early ideas about Lazar Kahanovich, and you were joking, uplift and oppression. I dreamed I was in the Politburo in my maiden form bra, which was hilarious. Now, this is not the tone throughout the book, which is, of course, a very tragic book in a lot of ways. But at the beginning, I feel like you were inviting the reader into your story through this kind of informal voice. So I wondered if you could talk about setting the tone for a nonfiction book.
Absolutely. This is something that I struggled with. The big question for me was how much of myself to put in the book. Now, I'm sure you're familiar, and many of your listeners are familiar, with the book The Lost by Daniel Mendelsohn, which is similar in some ways. He discovers a Holocaust story in his own family, and I think the subtitle is Six of the 6 Million. So he discovers that he has six relatives who were killed in the Holocaust, and one of them has a strong physical resemblance to him, and he traces his story. And his book, it's very long, it's very detailed, and a lot of it is about how he found the story. So it's really a memoir. It's really about him, his involvement with the history, his involvement with digging it up. And I decided very early on that that was not the kind of book I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. This is not about me. This is not about my discovery. This is about what I discovered. So the way I framed it, and I think this came to me fairly late, but I felt that it really clicked it into place was, as you said, the beginning does have a sort of light, it begins with a, kind of a little bit of a lighthearted tone of how I got discovered, you know, that Lazar Kahanovich was not in our family tree, and moved past that, and how I contacted the Israeli relatives, and how the story came into focus. But after that introduction, I bow out. And there is no more first person in the book until the epilogue. So, and as I say in the introduction, this is really not my story. It's their story. And I want to give their stories back to them, back to my ancestors. So that ended up being a very, to me, it just felt right. It felt like the way to write it so that I told the readers initially, I framed it by saying, you know, and I remember in college studying these framing devices, you know, for example, I think the famous one is the Scarlet Letter where, you know, the narrator says, well, I found this bunch of this old manuscript in some attic. And you know, I was working in the custom house in Salem, and, you know, I found this book, and, you know, and this musty old manuscript, and here's the story. And I always wondered why the college professors made such a big deal about the framing devices. But, you know, now I understand. It really does kind of set the tone in the reader's mind. And, you know, a story that begins once upon a time, or my favorite, you know, example is, you know, it was a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. You settle in for a story. You know, you kind of gather around children and here's the story. So I really wanted my book to have this kind of frame that it was clear to the readers that this was my story, and, you know, my family story, I should say. This was something that I, you know, that I had a couple of wrong turns and false leads. And then I leave. You know, I accept it, I frame the story, and I bow out. And then the rest of the book really is about them, and it starts with my great-great-grandfather in his town of Volozhin, which is a very famous yeshiva town in the Russian Empire, as it was then. Now it's part of Belarus. And I go right through World War II.
Nice.
And then when the war ends, I have a kind of a final chapter called Post-War, in which I talk about the survivors and how their lives were changed by the war, and they found, you know, the statehood for Israel, and how that changed the second branch of the family. And then at the very end, there's an epilogue in which I return and talk about how the book has changed me, and how inevitably, even though I say I'm giving the stories back to them, in my telling of it, in some ways, I make it my story. So I felt that that was, to me, that worked as a way to both you know, signal to the readers that this is my family, but not to turn it into a book about me.
Right. And it's interesting hearing you talk about it now. I noticed this, but I didn't put it together, that at the beginning you say you're giving the story back to your ancestors, but at the end you credit your cousin in Israel for having helped you and for other people having helped you, but
right.
You said, you know, I wrote this story, but it's not just mine, it's all of my family's, and that kind of also, you know, sort of closes that frame.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the cousin in Israel, and if I can just jump in and talk a little bit about him.
Sure.
You know, what a gift. So this is a cousin. His name is Benny. I'd never heard his name. I'd never met him. And when I was planning my first trip to Israel, I asked around other family members whether they had met him. And one of them said, well, his English is limited. He speaks NBA. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, he's really a basketball fan. So his English is kind of limited to talking about basketball. So I thought, well, you know, we'll work with it. And Benny and I totally, totally bonded. I mean, this was one of the great friendships of my life that just happened because of this book. And so I get off the plane in Tel Aviv. The first day, another cousin picks me up, and I was traveling with my older daughter, and we go to Benny's house, and he's this sort of big bear of a man. He's a little bit older than I am. And at first I was like, oh my gosh, you know, these are strangers. I'm going to be asking him about their parents, about their grandmother who was killed in the Holocaust. You know, what if they think I'm intrusive? You know, who are these people? They're my relatives, but they're perfect strangers. And we just became family instantly. And Benny, as it turns out, You know, in some ways, Benny's wife, Orna, said, Benny has been waiting for you all his life. Benny is a great amateur historian. He's a great family historian. He had a huge amount of reverence for his parents. And his mother, really, there were four children, but he was the one who recorded her memories, who sat down with her and really kind of got her life story and his father's life story, and this was the most precious gift of all, she entrusted him with 281 family letters. And these letters were written primarily by the relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. So this is really the last trace, and a very detailed, very intimate trace of these family members who were killed in the war.
Now, his mother was Sonia, right?
His mother was Sonia, right? And his father was Chaim, right? So Benny told me about these letters, but right when we met, and of course I perked up and went, oh, wow, letters, this sounds amazing. But he said, well, he'd never read them because they were written in Yiddish, and he doesn't know Yiddish, and I don't know Yiddish. And then he was a little reluctant about, well, you know, I'm not sure what to do with them. And it took a little coddling and a little pressure, but eventually Benny had all of the letters translated to Hebrew, and I had them all translated into English. And Benny really became my partner in doing the research, and it was a wonderful thing.
Now, actually, that sort of brings me into the story a little bit, because Benny's mother was Sonia, and Sonia's father was Shalom Tvi. Is that how you say it?
Shalom Tvi, that's correct.
And he was the one who you said was always called Uncle. Is that correct?
That's correct. All right. I'm impressed.
Now, he seemed to me in some ways the sort of central character of the book. Not really only him, but he was visiting America when the worst began to happen in his home base of Rakov. And he was unable to get back for the rest of the war, and he was also unable to join Sonia in the Holy Land, but they exchanged letters. So the book often focuses on his worry about his family in Rakov and his frustration about being stranded in New York. And I wondered, at what point in the process did you realize his role would be a central focus in the book?
You know, I realized it pretty early on. Because once I got in touch with the Israelis and found out about the relatives who were killed, I began to put together the family tree. And even though there were some blanks in it, nonetheless, really early in the research, I realized that, okay, so Shalom Tvi was my great-grandfather's brother. I know it gets a little confusing, but I think I can simplify it for your listeners. So he was really the pivotal character in the book because most of the family came to the U.S. Two family members, Sonia, Shalom Tvi's daughter, and Chaim, Shalom Tvi's nephew, went to the Holy Land, and the others remained in Europe. So the ones who remained in Europe were Shalom Tvi and his wife Bela, their two daughters, Doba and Edel, and their daughters' husbands and children. So it was really his family primarily that remained, his immediate family. So as you said, in 1939, 2 months before the war broke out, he came to the U.S. to visit. And I think really now that I have the letters, I understood that it really was more than just a visit. It was really to scope out and to kind of explore the possibility of bringing the rest of his family over. So he comes in July of 1939. He visits the World's Fair, which was very famous in that time, big World's Fair in New York. And then in September 1939, the war breaks out, and he's trapped in the U.S., and he is living in the same building as kind of a two-family home with my mother. So my mother is living downstairs with her parents and her siblings, and Shalom Tvi is upstairs with other family members. So he, you know, one of the most painful, agonizing parts of the research was reading Shalom Tvi's letters during the war. He wrote many, many letters to Sonia, and worrying, agonizing about the fate of his family. And, you know, this was a big question for me going in. What did he know, and when did he find out that his wife, his daughters, his sons-in-law, and his grandchildren were all killed by the Nazis? And, you know, I interviewed family members here, and of course the Israelis, and nobody really knew the answer, and I was getting conflicting accounts. Well, once I had the letters translated, the answer became clear that he never found out Eventually, when the war ended, people went back to Rakov and told the story of how the residents, the Jewish residents of Rakov, were herded into the synagogue and incinerated alive. So that was how most of Shalom Tzvi's family died. But that story did not come out until 1945. Mm-hmm. So he spent from 1939 to 1945 praying, wondering, agonizing, sleepless nights, torture, you know, really
just horrible. Right.
Horrible, being the living dead. And then as soon as the war ended, and as soon as it was possible to travel from the U.S. to what was still Palestine, he arranged a ship, and he got to Palestine and joined Sonia, who was really his only remaining immediate relative. All the rest of his family was killed. Sonia alone had survived because she was in Palestine. So he, as you said, he is the character in a way who binds the book together. He was in, it was Poland by World War II, but it had originally been Russia. He was in the old country. He was in New York for 7 years during the war. And then he ended up settling in Palestine. So the book is about, as I said, the three branches, and he really is the kind of pivotal figure. I wouldn't say he's the, you know, I think he's the pivotal figure. I think the emotional heart of the book, to me, really, I would say, belongs to three strong, iconic women.
Yeah.
One, and we haven't talked about her yet, is Idel, the founder of the Maid Form Bra Company, so she's the tycoon. Number two would be Sonia, the pioneer, who left her family, left her home, and really started a new life. And three, Doba, who is Sonia's sister, who was one of the family members who was killed in the Holocaust. And I have many, many, many letters from her that just make it clear that she was a devoted mother, loving sister. You know, she was just one of these warm-hearted people, persons who just always cares for and worries about and takes care of everybody.
Right.
And, you know, so she was the iconic mother. And to me, those three women really dominate the emotional landscape of the book.
At one point in the book, speaking of Idel, the woman who founded the Maiden Form Bra Company,
right.
At one point in this book, your narrative begins to go back and forth between Idel's story and Chaim's story. And Chaim is the cousin in Palestine who eventually marries Sonia. So it was so interesting to me. This chapter went back and forth between the New York business world and the Zionist clashes of the 20s in the Holy Land.
Right.
Such an interesting way to structure the chapter, because the times were the same, but the lives were so different. And I just wondered how you came to structure that particular chapter that way.
Yeah. Well, you were really putting your finger on all of the narrative spots and kind of knots for me. So thank you. These are things that you've really gotten to the heart of the book, and it's heart of the kind of the nuts and the bolts. So, okay, here's the story in brief. I wrote this book in a very weird way for me. Usually, and I've written many other books, usually I leave off the introduction till the very end, but I start with chapter one and right to the end, you know, and then do the introduction, which is maybe a little odd, but it works for me. For this book, I thought, well, I had my first research trip was to Israel, visited the relatives, saw all the places that Chaim and Sonia lived during the 1920s and 30s, and some of these were very remote settlements that have now been abandoned on above the Sea of Galilee, and, you know, really beautiful, almost like Death Valley type landscapes. And really, they took me around. We traced their own movement through what was in Palestine, and through the history of the early collective farms. They weren't on a kibbutz, but they were on another kind of collective called a moshav, which is basically the families have their own land and raise their own children, but the economy of the settlement is collective. So that was very stirring, very fresh in my mind, and I thought, okay, so I'll go home and I'll start writing the book with Chaim's story of how in 1924 he leaves what was then Poland and goes to the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it. And then I wrote Sonia's story. She left a few years later. And then I thought, okay, well, now I'll start kind of circling back. But it just didn't seem right to me. I wasn't that happy with how it came out.
You didn't want to just leave them there.
No, and it also, you know, I realized I didn't really have mapped out in my mind how the preceding chapters would go and how the chapters that followed went. You know, it was kind of like they were just stranded in the middle of this unwritten book. So, you know, there's every book I've done, there's always the roadblock. You know, you always hit a wall, and I go, okay, now what? How should I do this? So I thought, you know what, I'll do the next trip, which was to Belarus and Lithuania. We did what my Israeli relatives called a roots trip. We all went together, the two of them, and I went with my older daughter, and they went with their older sons. And we really kind of walked the walk of the places where the family lived and died. And when I came back from that trip, I thought, okay, I'm going to start at the beginning now. I'm going to do this properly the way I have done in the past. So I start at the beginning with my great-great-grandfather. And then I get up to the chapter that I already written about Chaim. And I thought, oh, geez, this really doesn't fit with the rest of the book at all. It's a different style. So I thought, okay, now what do I do? And at some point, I thought, I'm going to call this chapter Pioneers, because he was a pioneer. And I thought, you know what? Idyll was also a pioneer.
Yeah.
You know, she was a brassiere pioneer.
Right.
You know, she was somebody who came here as a young woman. She had very left-wing politics. She fled the Tsar's oppressive police in 1905. There was an uprising. And she went on to become a tycoon. Through her own gumption, through her own ambition, through this brilliant marketing genius that she had. And at that point, I thought, click, two pioneers, one in the Holy Land, one in New York, one making bras, one making the desert bloom. And it just kind of fell into place. And once I thought, once I decided to devote this chapter to the two of them, the rest of it was pretty easy. You know, I struggle a lot sentence by sentence. I'm a very slow writer. But once I kind of get the structure in place, I tend to, you know, it tends to just feel right. And so the other thing is a friend of mine who writes similar kinds of books in sort of narrative nonfiction, you know, this creative nonfiction, as we call it. His advice, which I almost always follow, is don't get too fancy or creative with the structure. Basically, follow chronology. Mm-hmm. If you've got a story that unfolds chronologically, just stick with that. And so you'll notice that in this chapter, which seems to have this intricate dance back and forth or swing pendulum back and forth between Palestine and New York, it actually pretty much follows chronology. Idyll founded the Maiden Form Bra Company in 1922. Chaim made his voyage in 1924. By 1924, Maiden Form was already, you know, a major brand and was sold in many department stores. In 1928, Chaim left his remote settlement and moved to a training farm. Idyll, meanwhile, you know, was dominating the market. So it wasn't really that hard once I went back and wrote the beginning of the book and figured out how to weave it in.
Okay.
But you put your finger on something that was, you know, this was kind of one of the knots that I untied.
You know, okay, so Chaim being a pioneer, that makes me think of something that I found interesting, which was he wasn't terribly, or correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he wasn't terribly religious. He was really into the whole emigration to Palestine, but he, at one point you say he would sing, but he would not pray. And
right.
What was that about exactly?
Yeah, well, again, this is a really interesting issue, and it's something that has kind of come up recently in the American press, but let me talk about the historic process in Palestine and then get to the current issue. Interestingly enough, and this is something I did not know when I began researching the book, many of the early Zionists were not religious at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were what we would call cultural Jews. They were very proud of their Jewish heritage, their Jewish background, their ethnicity. They were committed Zionists, so their dream was to establish a homeland for the Jewish people. And many of them, there was a whole spectrum of political belief, but they tended to be left-wing. So, you know, the early settlements were collective farms. I mean, they were Marxists, and they believed in you know, sharing everything and, you know, collective economy. So Chaim was typical of this. He really did not set foot in a synagogue. He was not somebody who, you know, his father and his grandfather and so on and so forth, way back as many generations as I was able to trace, were devout religious Jews, and they were scribes. They worked, their job was copying the Torah scrolls, copying the Word of God in Hebrew. And that was not for Chaim. So he was Jewish. He was very proud and very fierce in his Zionist ideology, but not at all religious. So that's a distinction that remains, well, important both in Israel today and in the U.S. Now, in Israel, the way it's played out recently is that the settlement movement has really swung from the left wing to the right wing. So in the 1920s, the period when Chaim went, as I said, many of the farmers, you know, the pioneers were socialists. Now the people who are founding these settlements in the West Bank tend to be devoutly religious, fanatically religious Orthodox Jews who believe that the Bible, you know, they're following the precepts of the Bible in, you know, taking the original borders of the Holy Land and so on and so forth. But these very controversial West Bank settlements are founded by religious Jews, not by socialist, atheist Zionists. So very interesting swing in Israeli politics and Israeli social history. But, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the Pew Report on Judaism in America, which talked about how many American Jews consider themselves cultural Jews, but not religious Jews. So this distinction, which I've actually written an op-ed about it, and I find the distinction is a little too broad and a little crude, but it is one that I think remains a very thorny issue for Jews. You know, how do you identify if you're not observant? You know, if you're like Chaim, you never set foot in a synagogue, does that mean you're still Jewish? You know, but can you, or, you know, if you are very proud of your Judaism and very determined to carry on the traditions and the reverence and the history of your people, you know, what kind of Jew are you then? And so I think these are unresolved issues, but certainly part of the book.
And I was going to ask you just sort of, I guess, quickly, but I know that you are not a very religious in your Judaism, and I wondered, you've said that in the book, and I wondered if researching and writing The Family changed either your Judaism or your attitude about religion and religious people.
Yeah, absolutely. Writing and researching this book has definitely changed my attitude toward Judaism, and I would say, briefly, it has made me much more reverent, both toward my religion and toward my ancestors. You know, as I mentioned, I come from a long line of scribes, mm-hmm. and I realized as I finished the book that I'm a kind of scribe, too.
Yeah.
I'm not the kind of scribe that they were. I don't copy sacred texts, but I do record the history, the passions, the tragedies, the events that have transformed my family. So I definitely feel a sense that I am standing in this line.
Yeah.
And I'm part of them. I've read a lot more in the Bible as a result of this book. I've studied a lot more Jewish history. And, you know, so I feel, I still am not part of a Jewish community. I have spent more time in synagogue since writing the book, which feels good. You know, Judaism was not, you know, I was I was the kind of kid who was very, very bored in synagogue and a little restless. And I remember, I don't know, you know, if your listeners can relate to this at all, but there's this song, Ein Kelohenu, which is what you sing at the very end of the morning service. And I was actually in synagogue a couple weeks ago, and I was so happy to sing this song. I was like, wow, what a great song. And I realized, oh, I love the song because it means the service is over and you can go out and run around. And so there's a little bit of me that is not really comfortable with ritual, but I definitely the reverence has increased, and the sense of strong connection with my family, and I think that that's the direct result of writing the book.
Yes, there were aspects of the book that I thought sort of obviously crossed religious borders in so far as people emigrating from Europe to the United States, as an example. And one question I had, my great-grandfather was an O'Connor, but he took the O off when he came to America. And likewise, in your family, Itzel became Ida, and so many new Americans changed their ethnic names. I wondered if we could talk a little bit about why that was, and also if that made researching the book more of a challenge for you.
Yeah, you know, this is something, another subject that I've devoted some time to. And, you know, I was under the impression that the names were changed in Ellis Island, that the immigrants got to Ellis Island and they had these long, foreign-sounding names. So Kahanovich became Cohen, and my father's name was Lanskevich, and that became Laskin. And I just thought, okay, well, you know, that's how they did it. But it turns out that's a kind of urban myth, urban legend. Ellis Island, and in fact, there's a great book called American Passage, which is a history of Ellis Island. And I've got it right on my shelf by Vincent Canato. And he says that did not happen. He says Ellis Island was not in the business of changing names. Then I thought, okay, yeah, as you just said. So how did this happen? And I think it happened, well, in a number of ways, but I think basically people were told, your name is not American enough, and, you know, your kids are going to be laughed at in school, or the teachers won't be able to pronounce it, or when you apply for your citizenship papers, you know, they won't be able to spell it. So I think there's a lot of pressure on immigrants to Americanize their names. Now, to some extent, Germans Americanized their names during World War I because it was very, very unpopular to be German American or have a German sounding name. I think some Jews changed their names to pass because, you know, to avoid anti-Semitism. In the case of O'Connor becoming Connor, it's possible, you know, I mean, the famous no Irish need apply signs, which my in-laws, my wife's name is Kathleen O'Neill, so you can guess what ethnicity she is. you know, they talk about coming up against prejudice against Irish, you know, people of Irish descent. So I think that there, some of it is to fit into the mainstream, some of it is to avoid prejudice. And you know, I think all immigrants have this story in their background.
Sure.
Of, you know, what about the name? And I think nowadays there's maybe more of a tendency to hold on to the immigrant names out of pride.
Did you know both of the names when you were trying to find some information about an ancestor, for example?
I did, and I found, you know, my grandfather's name was Sam Cohen, and he lived in Brooklyn, and I my very first time trying to use Ancestry.com, I entered Sam Cohen Brooklyn, and I came up with 340,000 possibilities. So, you know, Kahanovich probably would have been a little easier to research, but he was no longer named Kahanovich. So, you know, the definitely are... And I've devoted, again, you know, lots of time to genealogical research. And I really went to the experts. I was flummoxed. I really didn't know how to do this. So I went to the local library, and I found this fantastic genealogical researcher named John Lamont. And he told me how to use Ancestry. And, you know, the kind of one tip for your listeners, which was very helpful for me, when you're getting started, and if your ancestor is named, you know, John Jones or, you know, Sam Brown or something, where you're really, really having trouble narrowing your search down, you need a date. So if you have a birth date, you know, the exact birth date of your great-grandmother or whatever, that can be the key that opens the door. And that was true for me. So Sam Cohen, as I said, I had all of these possibilities, but then I had his birth date, and through that I was able to find his draft registration card for World War One, and that gave me his address, the address of his family, and bingo. Then I had all of them on the 1910 census, the 1920 census, and so on and so forth. And so it was really that one little piece of information that helped me. The other thing is that there are many, some of the sites, particularly ones for that specialize in immigrants, will allow you to enter not the exact name, but kind of the phonetic name. Mm-hmm. So if your name was, well, let's say Kahanovich is an example, which was spelled all these different ways, and sometimes with an H, sometimes with a G, because the G is pronounced H in Russian, you can just enter, you won't enter the exact spelling, you'll enter kind of a sounds like. And that can be one way to get around it.
Okay.
But, you know, I am doing an article about genealogy for Parade Magazine, which should be in a couple of weeks, and getting started. But, you know, briefly, everybody knows about Ancestry.com. I think the other great site is Family Search, which is run by the Mormons. And for Jewish listeners, there's something called Jewish Gen, J-E-N, which is the Jewish genealogical site. So, you know, it can be a little daunting to get going, but as I said, if you've got some specific date or address or, you know, the full official name of somebody with their middle name and so on, you might be able to get this to jumpstart the search that way.
Now, the story I've heard about the Mormon database is that what they actually are pursuing is to posthumously convert people. Is that just not true?
No, it is true.
It is true. Okay.
Well, it was true. I don't think they're doing that any longer. And, you know, I haven't really, I've seen conflicting accounts of that. But yes, there definitely was truth in that. And it was very, very controversial.
Yeah.
But I, you know, and that's, that was kind of their motive in pursuing genealogy so vigorously.
Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, one of the best databases of...
They have one of the best databases.
Yeah.
And people, you know, it's not just for Mormons. I mean, it's for everybody. So, you know, the motives, well, they're controversial. I don't think that's happening anymore. Don't quote me on that. I really can't say definitively, but I have heard through other sources in the genealogy community that is no longer taking place. But that being said, you know, in some ways, you could just sort of push that aside. But I have heard that many people have had really good luck in going to Salt Lake City and doing the research there. Or there's also local branches where you can access the same records. I think when you're in Salt Lake City, they're right there on microfilm. If you go to the local branch, they may have to order them. But, you know, if your family history is something that you're really, really curious about and really want to pursue, I would say no matter what your motives are in collecting this data, it may be worth your while to seek it out.
You mention in your notes and acknowledgments that some of this book comes from your imagination, and a minute ago you called it creative nonfiction. You put yourself as narrator into the minds of people who are long since dead, who left no record of their thoughts and experiences. So I wanted to know what personal guidelines you might have followed in doing this.
Right. So, you know, this is a somewhat controversial subject when you're, you know, writing creative nonfiction. How creative can you be? Mm-hmm. And my own personal guidelines are as follows. I do not invent any dialogue. So mm-hmm. if anything is in quotation marks, it's either from a letter or from a memoir written by another family member, or in some cases from interviews that I've done where, you know, there were three members of my grandfather's generation still alive, and they... I interviewed them, and they said, well, you know, I didn't really hear about the Holocaust stories, even though I was in the U.S. Army at the time. So, quote, unquote. That's the dialogue that I use. In terms of putting myself into the shoes, you know, imagining what my ancestors were going through, my guidelines were, I didn't invent anything, mm-hmm. but I did... combine sources and extrapolate. Here's an example. I tell when my great-grandparents came to the U.S., they arrived in 1909. It was the first day of June. And their son, Hyman, was with them. He, I think, was 17 at the time. And later in life, he wrote a self-published memoir. And he describes arriving at Ellis Island and going to the Lower East Side and getting to their cold water flat on Madison Street, not Madison Avenue, Madison Street, which is a very different kettle of fish from Madison Avenue. And he describes his mother bursting into tears when she sees this tenement flat that she's going to be living in. So I use that as the basis of a scene. Now, what I did was I did a lot of research into what the Lower East Side was like in 1909. I had maps of New York showing, you know, what the layout of the city and so on and so forth. And I also posted questions on a historical listserv on Jewish Gen asking, okay, so what was the likely means of transportation that an immigrant would use to get from the Battery, where the ferry from Ellis Island dropped them off, to the Lower East Side? So putting all of that together, and Hyman didn't say, oh, we took a taxi, we took a, you know, we took a horse-drawn trolley, whatever. He didn't specify. So some of the details I worked in based on likelihood. Mm-hmm. Some I worked in based on other people's accounts. Some I worked in based on historical fact. So I knew how crowded the Lower East Side was. I saw photographs of the push carts. I mean, we've all seen these pictures of what the Lower East Side looked like in 1909. Mm-hmm. I knew that the shop signs were predominantly in Yiddish. Today they're in Chinese, but back then they were in Hebrew characters. And so, as I said, I had Hyman's account. So putting all of this together, I created a scene of arriving at Ellis Island and getting to 175 Madison Street through the eyes of my great-grandmother. So, you know, there was some elaboration in that, you know, I didn't know exactly how many people she saw on a certain street corner, but I knew that she saw many more people that day than she'd ever seen in her life, because her village in what was in Russia had 3,000 people. The Lower East Side had millions. And, you know, it was one of the most crowded places in the world. So I did take some creative liberties in, you know, putting myself into her shoes and seeing the world through her eyes, but none of it was invented. It was all based on either what her son had written or what other immigrants of the period had written. So, you know, writing a novel, you can pretty much say anything you want as long as it has some sort of authority and the ring of truth. I use stricter rules for myself. You know, a historian probably would say, well, you know, you've crossed the line. I feel like I've crossed the line that I'm allowed to cross, or I've allowed myself to cross, because I, as I said, I do not invent. I synthesize, I combine, and, you know, I make sure that everything has some historic validity. And then I use the footnotes to describe my sources and describe my narrative choices.
And in your acknowledgments, you do say that this was your process,
right,
which is another way of not crossing that line, mm-hmm, because you're not claiming that this is all fact.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned Hyman's memoir a minute ago. Hyman's mm-hmm memoir was published in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And in that memoir, apparently there's mention of the fact that they never discussed the death of Shalom Zvi's family. The quote in the book is, "We never talked about it. We never knew. It never came up. No one mentioned it." And this is true of my husband's family as well. His grandparents emigrated from Eastern Europe, having fled mm-hmm the pogroms. And whenever he was asked about the family history, he would say, "I got out. I'm never going back. I don't want to talk about mm-hmm it." So this after effect of not speaking of terrible things seems, you know, mm-hmm, somewhat common to people who have survived these horrors. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if you could speak to this, and also speak to your own need or desire to write about it, mm-hmm, and the importance that ultimately the story is told.
Right. You're absolutely right that this is very common, and I would even say universal. I've done a lot of traveling speaking about the book. in the last couple of weeks, and many people come up to me after my talks and say, we never heard about it. We have either a Holocaust story or a story of immigration from the pogroms, and exactly what your husband's family said. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been studies of this, and I think it's very common, and I think it makes emotional sense, that survivors and immediate descendants of survivors of genocide, whether it's the genocide in Eastern Europe during the Holocaust, whether it's Rwanda or Bosnia or Native Americans for that matter, or even African Americans and the slavery, which is I think is a form of genocide, mm-hmm. what happened from West Africa to the North American enslavement. You know, the people who were enslaved or the Native American families who were decimated were not the ones writing memoirs or even recounting it in their families. It was taboo. It was too painful. It was too immediate. It was too raw. Mm-hmm. To some extent, I think it was too shameful. And this is well established across many cultures and many ethnic histories. So, you know, your second question is why me? And I think I am the generation, and Benny, my cousin, who I've talked about, is the same generation. It really falls to us. I think we are the ones who can face it, who can talk about it. Mm. And face it is actually too mild a word. I mean, I think for both of us, it became a kind of obsession to learn the truth, to find out everything we could. And, you know, it was really interesting in pursuing this research. My mother is still alive and well and completely cogent. And, you know, she was very helpful in some of the research that I pursued. But I could feel her backing off mm-hmm. from anything having to do with the Holocaust. And it just, you know, it wasn't that she said, no, you know, I don't want to talk about it or go away. She just kind of really kept it at arm's length. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I do think that in many ways my generation is probably the best placed in that we're not so involved emotionally that we can't face it, but the records remain fresh, and the interest, the, you know, the passion to uncover our history, our family roots, our stories. I mean, the fact, you know, these children who were killed, the family members who were killed, were Benny's first cousins. Mm. So, you know, these are close family. And I think this impulse to learn what happened, exactly what happened, when. I mean, I think that we tend to think of the Holocaust as kind of this monolith, this nightmare that descended in Europe. And we think of it as kind of a Steven Spielberg movie. The trains, the gas chambers, you know, the crematoria, you know, that's our image of the Holocaust. But only one of my 17 family members was killed by gas. Mm-hmm. So the others, each death was different. Mm-hmm. And I feel in many ways it's our duty, or certainly it was my duty and Benny's duty, to find out exactly how each of them died and to try to preserve the memories of, you know, many of them were children.
Yeah.
Really to kind of give them some story, some permanence in the human record.
Yeah. I wondered how Benny and your extended family have reacted to the book.
Right. So I got an email from Benny and the day it was published, which Benny has very colorful and wonderful English, not quite precise, but very, very vivid. And he just said, oh, this book means the world to us. And we are so proud to be in the same family. We remember so fondly and so vividly standing together by the grave of our common ancestor and saying the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. Mm. So that meant a lot. Benny's sister also wrote and said, we cannot stop to read the book, which puzzled me for a while, but then I realized what she meant was we can't put it down. And so that was very sweet and very touching. The rest of the family has been fine. I mean, the reactions have ranged. You know, people are all different, from thank you so much, this was so moving, we love seeing our story told, and to, oh, I found a couple of typos on various pages.
That's perfect.
You know, people, everybody has their own way of expressing their appreciation, but I think everybody has appreciated it. There are a couple of sensitive things, well, more than a couple, but a couple that really worried me, revelations, things that nobody had ever said before that came out in interviews that I struggled with. Well, should I put this in? Is this going to hurt people? And I actually met with the daughter of Aunt Rose, one of the few members of that generation who remains. And I said, was your mother okay with me putting this in? And she said, absolutely. It was, you were very sensitive and you did it delicately. So that was a relief. But yeah, so far so good. Everybody's liked it.
Okay. Well, I have one last question for you, David. I wondered, so my show is for writers as well as readers, and I wonder if you have any advice for people writing nonfiction that touches on their own lives.
Right. Well, you know, I think my major advice would be to be aware of these narrative issues that we've talked about, you know, how to put yourself into the narrative or not, and resolve the question of point of view and the question of you know, what liberties to take in terms of creative nonfiction. You know, for me, and everybody's process is different, but my process is that I do a draft and kind of spill it. I spill slowly, so maybe drip it is it's more apt. But, you know, the draft comes out, and it's, in many ways, it's very emotional, especially in a book like this. But then I step back, and in revising and doing subsequent drafts, that's when I start using some of the techniques that we learned in school or that we read about in guides for how to write, the techniques of shaping point of view or, you know, use of first person or, you know, how to incorporate historic sources or how to use quotations. And then you become much more like a surgeon. And, you know, one of the things that I did in this book, which worked well, of course, every book is different, was to try to give all of the major figures in my family at least one scene told from their point of view. So as we mentioned earlier, the arrival of the New World is told from the point of view of my great-grandmother. You know, the founding of the Maidenform Bra Company, obviously told from the point of view of Idyll. Some of the scenes in the Holocaust, one of them I told from the point of view of a 5-year-old girl who was killed. And that was something that I decided fairly late in the day, but I think it ended up, and you might not even be aware of it when you're reading the book, but I think if you step back and think about it, you'll probably conclude that the vividness, the momentum of the narrative comes from that. So I think it's a two-step process. One, get it on the page. Two, shape it really dispassionately using some of the techniques that all writers use. And I think those two will work very well for almost everybody.
Great. That's really good advice. That's all my questions for you. I want to thank you so much. David Laskin, the book is The Family, Three Journeys into the Heart of the 20th Century, published by Viking. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Sheila. It was a great interview. I really appreciate you taking the time.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David Laskin. You can read more about his work at his website, davidlaskin.com. And from there, you can find links to many of his recent articles, including the USA Today piece that he mentioned during our conversation about the Pew Study on American Jews and Religion. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write about someone who follows through on a bad idea, even though they know it will be a mistake. Good luck with your work in the coming week. And please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion.
Every week I give a little pandemic update. I'm sure you know that numbers in this country are getting better. Vaccinations are going up. but we still are trying to be safe and careful. So as I say every week, specific to writers and readers, please try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours have been canceled. Everything, as you just heard, a lot of things are still virtual. So, you know, I know we're getting tired of Zoom, but it's still wonderful to hear people read from their work. It's wonderful that so many people from all over the world can attend each other's events. So try to find the authors whose books have come out and try to attend their events. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of Write the Book offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. I said this last time, too. I'm going to have a change in format coming up on the show. Before I formalize that, I'd love to hear from as many of you as possible about the things you do and do not like about Write the Book and what you might like to see change. If you do like the show, please rate it where you find it and like it on the social media sites that you use. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Pandora, and other sites where you get your podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.